So I'm trying to get some of these ideas for Purim out. There's a deadline looming. Matzei Shabbos Sunday. It's an idea that I've been toying around with this year. It's a little late at night, so I just want to try to record this to get it out there. It's not as obviously central to the narrative of the Megillah, but I do think that it accentuates an important sub-theme of Megillah's Esther. A very famous Gemara, Amar Belazar Amchanina. You should, of course, if this one Gemara whom you should quote the source, this is the Gemara. Kala Omer Davar B'Shem Omro. If you cite your sources, when you hear some Torah, you cite the person who taught you that Torah, or the source of that Torah. Mevi Geula Li'olam. You bring redemption, you accelerate redemption. Shenemar V'Tomer Esther L'Melech B'Shem Mordechai. Of course, in the Megillah, Mordechai uncovers the assassination plot of Bigtan and Teresh, relays the information to Esther, who in turn relays it to Ahasuerush in Mordechai's name. Mordechai gets the credit. Mordechai is entered into the registry of heroes. At some point, that standing and that behavior merits Ahasuerush defending Mordechai, or at least encouraging Haman to parade Mordechai through the streets of Shushan, which leads to Mordechai's success and Haman's downfall, to the turnaround of Vinhafachu. So because Esther cited this information, this intel, in the name of Mordechai, it led to our redemption, it led to our salvation. So, of course, we're living in a period of plagiarism, in which people don't often quote their sources, and we've seen how many of the seemingly anti-Semitic forces or anti-Semitic abetting forces have also been accused of plagiarism. And every anti-Semite is essentially a plagiarist because they're just recycling worn and classic tropes to attack our people and twisting the truth in ways that has been twisted in the past and weaponized against our people. But I don't want to talk about that tonight. I want to talk about something else. I was toying around this year with the following two questions. Number one, this is a generic or general universal value to cite your sources, whether it's in general for the sake of honesty and moral integrity, whether it's for Torah sources because of recognition that Torah isn't yours and humility. And it, in theory, this drasha could have been slotted in anywhere in Tanakh. It just so happens that Chazal saw it staring at them in Megillah's Esther, so they attached the drasha to Esther. But is this just some tack-on drasha that has absolutely nothing to do with the story of Megillah's Esther and the miracle of Megillah's Esther and the broader moral values of Megillah's Esther? It just so happens that there's a story of Megillah's Esther, and incidentally, in the story, unrelated to the overall value system that Megillah's Esther is trying to convey, there happens to be some very important value that peeks out at us in the end of Perek Beis when Mordechai uncovers the plot. Or is there something very innately parallel or synchronous between the overall message system of Megillah's Esther, whatever messages it's trying to signal and to deliver, and this particular value? The second question, relatedly, I believe, is when Chazal said, "Mevi Geula Li'olam." They were trying to extol the value of citing your sources, of repeating the source of any information that's important and useful, certainly Torah information. So they spoke in very exultant and triumphant terms. Mevi Geula Li'olam. And of course, in Megillah's Esther, it was Mevi Geula Li'olam. So for them to use that phrase, even if it's hyperbole, even if it's a generic phrase, it makes sense because in the context of Megillah's Esther, it was Mevi Geula Li'olam. But is there anything inherent about citing your sources, which is Mevi Geula Li'olam, as opposed to accomplishing many other important goals? Chazal sometimes say, Muftach lo shu ben olam haba. Marichan lo yama vishnosav. Whatever accolades Chazal, and sometimes they spoke in hyperbole, which is fine because it accentuates the value of that trait. Why did they say in this context, Mevi Geula Li'olam? Is it only because it just happens to be in Megillah's Esther that we happen to find someone relaying the source of information, which happens to then contribute to Geula? So being that the context, which could have been any other context, it's an incidental context, it's unrelated to the overall narrative, is one of Mevi Geula Li'olam, so Chazal said me, Or was there something more precise and more deliberate about Chazal drawing this value out of Megillas Esther and then associating this value as a or identifying this value as a Geula accelerant or a Geula catalyst as it was in Megillas Esther? So these are two questions that I remember when I first thought of them. Some questions you think about and you leave unresolved and you come back later in life. And I think that is an important trait. I think sometimes we need to find the answer. And we sometimes don't find the answer that settles and sits right within our hearts. And we hear it's maybe another answer. We don't find an answer. And you have to have the capacity to say, I haven't found the answer to this question yet, or one that sits deeply into my consciousness. And I'll come back to it. I'll come back to it at some other point in my life. Megillas Esther, we read once a year, twice a year, actually. Anyway, so these are some of my thoughts. I'm still in the preliminary stages of articulating it, but somehow, the last day or two, these are the ideas that came to mind. There is a moral contest between Esther and Haman in Megillas Esther. Many moral contests. Not that they're fighting each other at some moral round table discussing morality. They're not learning Maseilas Yesharim. But they are demonstrating different values. They're showcasing, presenting different values. Haman is an unrepentant, unqualified egotist. And I would say it's sad, but nothing about Haman's demise is sad. But if you take the Amalek part out of the story, if you take the annihilator of the Jews out of the story, it's a Greek tragedy. A person who's made it, they are unlimitedly wealthy, have all the resources they need, and they're so egotistical and so megalomaniacal and so desirous of attention and of public image. And as I spoke about in one of the early shiurim, when you create a culture of greed and a culture of avarice and a culture of acquisition, at a certain point you run out of money to collect, either because there's no more money that you can make or because another couple billion won't make a difference in your final ledger. It'll just be swallowed up. And then it becomes about making the Forbes list of the 10 richest people in the world, or rising to the top of that list. And then it becomes out-competing others. And at some point, greed to acquire money morphs into greed to acquire title and public prestige and public image and public honor. And it happens in every single context, in every single culture. There is a correlation between avarice and egotism. And Haman falls into that trap. What I said before, it's tragic. Just take a few steps out. Disassociate yourself from the heinous, heinous crime that Haman attempted. Forget our Haman right now. Make believe. It's the middle of the night here. I woke up in the middle of the night to record this. I think I can get it right. Baruch Mordechai and Arur Haman. Take yourself out of that moral equation. It's just sad. He had everything. And there's one old Jew, a leftover refugee from Yerushalayim, who doesn't want to bow down to him. So walk away, walk past him, and Haman can't. And it's that moment that Haman seals his fate. And it's his egotism and his false pride, his megalomaniac desire for every single person to notice him, that begins his spiral. And then he continues to spiral when he is invited to Esther's party. And he sees Mordechai a second time. Vayimaleh Haman al Mordechai chema again. Not only have you arrived financially and in the culture of Shushan, but the queen herself has her eyes on you. And your path to glory and to power and to influence is clear. And yet, Mordechai angers him. He builds the tree that ultimately he's hung upon, the gallows. And then he walks into Achashverosh's, not trap, but he walks into Achashverosh's palace. And he hears Achashverosh describing what can only be the honor due Haman, because there's no one else that could possibly deserve that honor. And again, it's his pride, and he escalates the treatment that he believes he'll be receiving, and ultimately it's Mordechai who receives the bonus. And time and again, he just can't get out of the way of his own ego and his own self-promotion and his own desire for honor and title. And Esther is the antidote to that type of egotism and that type of attention drawing. And it's not just about when she cites Mordechai, although I'll talk about that in a moment, it's the way she conducts herself, and not just vis-a-vis Haman, but vis-a-vis the degenerate culture of Shushan, of exhibitionism and voyeurism, of partying 180 days in open spectacle and open view. And Esther's parties are much quieter. Esther's parties are conducted in the inner chambers of the royal palace, not the outer courtyards for everyone to gawk at them. How do I know that Esther's parties, the two parties that she conducts, are in the inner chambers? Because on that second party, that second day, Ahasuerus goes storming out of the party when he discovers the identity of Haman, and he runs out to the Chasar HaMelech, to the Ginas HaMelech, to the garden, because the parties are inside, in the Beis HaMalchus. And in part, it's because Esther is very private, and she doesn't tell, she doesn't reveal her identity, which drives Ahasuerus mad, which ironically, and I don't mean mad in the sense of furious, but he's very tantalized by this mysterious woman. So much of romance is mystery and discovery and mystique, and having nothing to do with this year, but it's almost 2 a.m. here in Eretz Yisrael, so my mind is wandering. And I've spoken about this before. That's part of the what we call the shidduch crisis and the dating crisis and the crisis of romance in today's world. It's so hard to find mystique because we know so much about, I'm not in the dating scene, but people know so much about each other before they meet. And part of dating is discovery and conquering the unknown and filling yourself up with knowledge about a person and falling in love with that person the more you get to know them. And when everything's on the table, same thing with clothing, when there's no cover-up in clothing, everything is just flash, so it's hard to feel attraction because everything is presented. And Ahasuerus is captivated by this mysterious woman whose identity he just can't discover. And part of the reason he's ensnared in the party is that he wants to find out Esther's identity, and he ultimately does. But there's also a moral, not just a manipulative aspect to this, but Esther doesn't draw attention to herself. I think Mar Megillah talks about Esther as a tsanua, and tsanias is not just how you cover your body, but tsanias is whether you are self-promotional, draw attention to yourself. And the reverse side of tsanias is egotism and self-promotion and vanity. And when Esther reports this information in the name of Mordechai, she's a newly queened woman. She's uncomfortable in the king's palace. Obviously, she's a little girl. She follows the orders of Shashgaz and Haggai to a T. She follows the instructions of Mordechai. It's not like she comes walking in as some princess of a different country with all the political clout of her former empire. She's a child. She's an orphan. She has no parents. So for her, it's perfectly natural to want to score some points and rack up some credit and increase her standing in the court palace and take credit for saving the king. And everyone will talk about Esther. And she defers to Mordechai. And that's a moral moment. It's not just Esther writing her PhD and making sure she's checking the boxes and citing her sources, which is a moral moment, of course, because it's honesty. But here it's a moral moment because it's consistent, and it's in line with Esther's legacy as a tzenua, as the Gemara and Megillah extols her as. So I don't think that this concept of citing other people, I don't think this context or concept is completely incidental to the moral context of Megillah's Esther, because the value of citing sources is not just what we would call in the academic world intellectual honesty. There's a moral value to it, and it stems from humility and not needing the attention, and not wanting to impress people disingenuously, and not wanting to present ideas that aren't yours as if they are yours, and trying to display your own creative energies and your own creative, but being able to trace it back to people before you. There's a humility and a privacy that's the antidote to the exhibitionism and self-aggrandizement and self-promotion that Haman tries to bring to Shushan. And quite frankly, he doesn't have to bring much of it because Shushan is already mired in that cesspool of exhibitionism and self-promotion. So I don't think this drasha is just a tack on drasha that could have been tacked on just as easily to Koheles or just as easily to, I don't know, Eov or Rus. It's germane. It's latent within one of the moral storylines of Megillas Esther. And getting to the second question, when Chazal said, maybe Geula Li Olam, I believe that they meant that for Geula to happen, when Geula happens through human intervention, obviously we look to Kadosh Baruch Hu to be the goal of Yisrael, but we also realize that sometimes he wants human beings to redeem themselves, and at least the way we read Megillas Esther, the story we're meant to read, is of human beings who redeem themselves and save the day. And for Geula to happen, there have to be people that act not out of self-interest and selfishness, because that won't lead to the greater good on behalf of the tzibur, on behalf of the collective. It has to be people who act selflessly and are willing to fall on the sword on behalf of something larger, and in this case, Jewish peoplehood, Jewish history, Jewish survival. If people aren't willing to act with moser nefesh, and moser nefesh means preparing to die, not wanting to die, known as a death wish, but knowing that there are values larger than your own survival that have to be served, and someone has to serve those values. And as I speak now, at my comfortable desk in my house in Halon Shvat, there are people, and there are young men and young women, who are living that saga, living that narrative. And sadly, over the last 5 months, there are so many. I just, lived through, as everyone else in this country lived through, I'm not sure how much people in Klitz were aware or engaged in the event. I just spoke to someone tonight who hadn't heard of it, of the Levaya and the Shiva of Daniel Peretz, whose father is a well-known public figure, the director of Mizrahi, World Mizrahi. And he was just confirmed dead, and his Levaya took place, and the Shiva took place, or is taking place this week. And all the other soldiers who have fallen, and all the other people who are risking their lives. So unless you have someone who's willing, and Megillas Esther is no different. If you're looking for one phrase that's the turning point of our Geula, or one phrase that captures the self-sacrifice and the Mesiras Nefesh that's necessary for Geula, it's when Esther says, Kasher Avadati Avadati. And I know Chazal Darshan that now that she is willfully entering a marital relationship with Achashverosh, she'll be Aser to Mordechai, the Gemara in Sanhedrin Ayin Dalet. But the simple reading is, she is risking her life. Now, how is she risking her life? Either because she may not receive the extended scepter, and she hasn't been called already for more than 30 days, so Achashverosh could fly off into some arbitrary fit of rage and say, how dare you enter my palace without being called? Off with your head, as he's been known to do. Or, as many of the Mefarshim interpret, Esther's plan A was to throw herself on the sword with Haman. How can she scuttle this genocidal plan? The only way is to raise suspicion, which she is, by conducting these parties, and to come out, because Haman isn't going to confess. And who knows if Achashverosh is going to be willing to listen to her words. It's going to be he said, she said, and she's going to accuse him, and he's going to deny it. She's going to basically say, I'm the one. I am plotting to kill you, and you know who my wingman is? You know who my Robin is? I'm Batman or I'm Batwoman. You know who my Robin is? The man that right next to me. That's why he's been coming to the party. And at that point, since, after all, she's self-implicating, she's describing herself, why would she be lying about herself? Achashverosh is more likely to accept her accusation and indictment of Haman. So she's prepared. She obviously sees a different angle on day two, when she sees Haman being humiliated, and she smells the tea leaves, and she knows where things are heading, so she reverts back to the direct accusation of Haman without implicating herself. But she's basically willing to fall on the sword and implicate herself falsely, so that Am Yisrael could die, and that's what she said, could survive. Kasher avadati, avadati. And I said this in one of the early shurim today to the boys, reminiscent of Yaakov, who at some point makes peace with the fact that for the family to survive, Binyamin may have to be endangered. He may never see Binyamin again. And he says, Kasher shecholti, shecholti. And how many parents across the country over the past 5 months have entered into this state of shechol? Shechol means losing a child in modern Hebrew, based on Yaakov's pasuk. How many people have recognized that by moving to Eretz Yisrael, that is a fate that may await them, that may haunt them, that may afflict them? So, only by people acting not out of self-interest, but selflessly, can Geula happen. That's how you break the cycle of suffering, is by people acting heroically. And heroically means self-sacrifice, and sometimes the ultimate self-sacrifice. So, I believe that maybe Geula Lolem doesn't mean only the schus of citing your sources Ulita HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivering Gula to our people. Obviously, everything in Megillas Esther is driven by Hashem. But we're asked to see Megillas Esther as a standalone narrative without Yad Hashem and seeing values and how those values have consequences. And the consequence of Gula, or the material, the ingredients necessary for Gula, is selflessness. And selflessness is something that Esther possesses and is manifest by her deferring the honor and the credit to Mordechai. So it's likely, okay, in your life, if you see people that cite their sources and are humble, it's likely they'll also act out of selflessness. Whereas people who will not cite sources want the attention, want the credit, and are less likely to act selflessly. They're more likely to act selfishly, and they're not going to be direct contributors to a geula process because they'll be drawing attention to themselves. And when the self is endangered, they'll choose the self over the broader collective. These are some of my thoughts as to why Chazal tagged this drasha to Megillas Esther and how this value contributes to geula without just seeing this phrase as a generic maybe geula l'olam, because that's what happened to be the benefit and the consequences in Megillas Esther. Hope this is clear. It's very late at night, but I know that time is ticking away, especially given the time difference till Purim.